This week we read two parashios, Behar and Bechukosai. Behar deals with two major areas, that of the law of Shemitah, the sabbatical year of the land every 7 years where we are not allowed to work the land, which currently is the status in Israel this year, and Yovel, which is the 50th year after seven cycles of seven Shemitahs. The 50th year is a Jubilee year where there's liberty proclaimed throughout the land, people's inheritance returns back to them, certain slaves go free, and once again the land is not worked. The second part of the Parsha of Behar deals with laws of helping out poor people, redeeming their field if they're impoverished, giving them loans without charging interest, and even if a person is so impoverished they're sold into slavery into you, how a person should treat the slave that is with them. Parshas Bechukosai deals also with a major theme, and that is the brachos and the klalos, the blessings if we listen to God, the curses if we do not. And as we know, there was a takana that 2 weeks before Shavuos we should read about the brachos and klalos to see what would happen if we don't keep the Torah. And likewise, 2 weeks before Rosh Hashanah, we read the brachos and klalos that are found in Parshas Ki Tavo, also to prepare our mind frame for the Yom HaDin, for that day of judgment as well. I'd like to ask one question in regards to Parshas Behar, one in regard to Parshas Bechukosai, and really see how the two questions really form one rubric, one mindset that will be our approach for today. We find in Parshas Behar that after we're told the laws of the law of Shemitah, of the sabbatical year, and Kadosh Baruch Hu promises that there'll be a blessing in the 6th year, that there'll be enough produce for 3 years. The pasuk says, since the land is mine, no land shall be sold permanently. You're foreigners and resident aliens as far as I'm concerned, and therefore there shall be a time of redemption for all your hereditary land. We then speak about the different aspects of social laws and social justices. We have, the immediate section is, if your brother becomes impoverished and sells some of his hereditary land, how a close relative can come and redeem what his kinsman has sold. And you calculate the number of years until the Jubilee year, and the Jubilee year will return back to that individual, and that will be the real estate value. If there are many years for the Jubilee year, the price will be much higher than if there are fewer years. After that section dealing with the Jubilee year and the laws connected with the Jubilee, we then have when your brother becomes impoverished and loses the ability to support himself in the community, you must come to his aid, you have to help him survive. You cannot take advanced interest or cured interest from him. Fear your God and let your brother live alongside of you. The next law is, if your brother becomes impoverished and is sold to you, do not work him like a slave. He shall be with you just like an employee or resident hand. The Torah continues, do not dominate such a slave to break his spirit, since you must fear your God. The first question I'd like to ask is, why are these laws of supporting one's brother, of making sure that a person who's impoverished has sustenance, that if indeed they need to be sold into slavery, that you treat them properly, why are all these laws of social interaction put specifically in Parshas Behar? What is the connection between the Shemitah year, the sabbatical year, the Jubilee year, and these laws of the supporting of the poor people? It's interesting because the Medrash, the Gemara itself, sees a connection. It's really a negative connection, so to speak. I'd like to just note it in order to see the entire picture, and I'd like to, Amir Hashem, today focus on more of a positive aspect. But the Gemara says the following, it's very fascinating, and there's a lot to learn from it. The Gemara says, as quoted by Rabbi Monk in the Call of Torah, that the Talmud sees this verse as a direct result of not observing the laws of Shemitah. We find in Kiddushin, Rabbi Yosef Bar Chanina points out that even the slightest violation of the law of Shemitah will have a serious effect. And he speaks about if a person is not careful about selling the fruits of the 7th year, a person who does so will eventually be punished and come to sell his personal property. If he does not take heed from this lesson, he will end up becoming impoverished and having to sell his fields as well as described in this verse. Should he still fail to react, he'll have to sell his half. If he still does not change his ways, he will even have to sell his daughter as a maidservant. Although the sale of the girl is not mentioned in this context, it is taught that one would rather sell his daughter into slavery than borrow money with interest. For the ransom money necessary to free his daughter decreases with time, whereas the amount needed to pay back an interest-bearing loan continually increases. As his degradation continues, the person arrives at the stage of borrowing money with interest, and finally he's reduced to selling himself into slavery, which is the ultimate degradation when he sells himself into slavery. So here the Gemara clearly sees the interrelationship between all these laws and Shemitah, that these will be the necessary results, the consequences. If a person doesn't keep Shemitah, understand the severity of Shemitah, that this is what's going to happen to you. And it's really a stage-by-stage process where God causes first small things to result, financial hardships, and then much more major things as a wake-up call for the person. If you don't respond and you don't repent, this is where you are headed. And that beautifully ties in all the different parts of the parasha together and connects it to the laws of Shemitah and Yovel. I'd still like this question to stand. Can we perhaps see it on a positive aspect of the connection of these laws and the lessons that perhaps they come to teach us? The second question I'd like to deal with is found in Parshas Bechukosai. It's a very famous question. Parshas Bechukosai, when it begins, the aspect of the Telcha of the rebuke states, but if you do not listen to me and do not perform all these commandments, if you consider my decrees revolting, and if your being rejects my ordinances, in order not to perform all my commandments, to annul my covenant, then I will do the same to you. I will sign you panic, swelling lesions, burning fever, causing eyes to long and souls to suffer. You will sow your seeds in veins, for your enemies will eat it, etc., etc. So here we know that the Ramban understands that this particular section of the Tocha of the rebuke in Sefer Vayikra to be referring to Bais Rishon, the exile, the Babylonian exile, the destruction of the first temple, while the rebuke that's found in Sefer Devarim in the book of Deuteronomy is a reference to the second temple period. So if we understand, according as we do according to Nachmanides, that this is a specific reference to Churban Bais Rishon, destruction of the first temple, so I'd like to look at one aspect of the destruction of the first temple. And that's a verse in Yirmiyah, a very famous verse, where Yirmiyah Navi says, who is the wise man that may understand this? And who is he to whom the mouth of the Lord has spoken that he may declare it? Why has the land perished, burnt up like a wilderness, and none passed through? And the Lord said, right, the question Yirmiyah Navi asked is, why is there a churban? Why is there a destruction? And God himself responds, because they have forsaken my Torah, which I set before them, and have not obeyed my voice, nor walked therein. And to this the Gemara says, the question of why the temple was destroyed and the land left desolate was posed to the sages and the prophets. None could explain until God himself revealed that a result was having forsaken the Torah. And the Gemara continues that the failure to listen to God's voice and walk in the Torah's ways does not refer to studying the Torah as we would understand it. There were people involved in study of the Torah, people involved in Torah mitzvot at the time of destruction of the first temple. Rather, in a very famous statement of the Gemara, it refers to their failure to recite Birkas HaTorah. Language of the Gemara is Shelo Berchu BaTorah Tchila, that they did not literally say a blessing before they began learning Torah. And this Gemara is spoken about by a lot of the commentaries. What exactly does this mean? Clearly, when they woke up in the morning, they said Birkas HaTorah. They said the blessing of the Torah before they learned. That's a normal practice. Before we learn Torah in the morning, no matter what else we do, we say Birkas HaTorah, the blessings of the Torah. So the second question we have today is, how do we understand, at least according to some approaches, Shelo Berchu BaTorah Tchila, that they didn't say a blessing before they learned Torah, and that was the cause and that was the reason for the Churban Bayis, for the destruction of the first temple? These two questions, the correlation between the two ideas in Parshas Behar and the reason for their destruction of the first temple, what it means, Shelo Berchu BaTorah Tchila, really work hand in hand together to form a composite picture. The first approach I'd like to take is really, I think, a very basic idea of the interrelationship between Shemitah and the social interpersonal laws. But it's developed, I think, very beautifully in an essay in a book called Chachma U'Musar. It was written by Rabbi Dr. Salomon Breuer. He was Rav Hirsch's son-in-law, and he was the father of Rav Yosef Breuer, Rabbi Yitzchak Breuer, who we are more familiar with in terms of their works and in terms of that which they've done. But Joseph Breuer was the founder of the Washington Heights community, the Breuer's community there. And his father, this Rabbi Dr. Salomon Breuer, was the Rav in the Frankfurt Kehillah of the Kaladas Yeshurim. He's writing, he's a rabbi there, 1890s, 1920s. So we have the time period where he's writing, where he says the following. He says, the Medrash itself connects, Medrash and the Tanchuma, these two aspects. The aspects of the institution of Shemitah and the ensuing great social laws which demand strict observance of righteousness and social justice in Jewish life. The Medrash says that the interrelationship is based really on the Pasuk from Mishlei, from Proverbs, that the selfish person piles up wealth and does not even realize that want will be his life. And the Medrash continues, this applies to Cain, who murdered his brother because he wanted the world for himself, and he never realized that his deeds caused only anguish for him, because in the end, he ends up his cursed existence as a refugee, constantly on the run. So we find here that there's this interconnection between the two, and the model of the interconnection is the model of Cain, who wanted more and more, and in the end landed up with less and less. Rabbi Breuer develops this medrash in a very fascinating way. He says, let's understand, why did God indeed reject Cain's offering? What was the source of the jealousy between Cain and Hevel, which resulted ultimately in the murder of Hevel? So we know clearly that the Torah tells us that Cain brought from the fruit of the ground as a gift offering to God, and Hevel brought of the best of his sheep and their fat as a gift offering to God. What was the difference between the two? So rabbis tell us that Cain brought the leftover from his own food, while Hevel brought the firstborn. And he notes that Cain ridiculed the spirit which the divine law desired to plant in the Jewish people through the annual Bikurim rites. What Cain basically is doing is rejecting the whole concept of Bikurim, the concept of the first fruits. Since we're coming up to Shavuos very soon, first fruits is a very appropriate thing to speak about. Rabbi Breuer develops this very briefly, and he says that what is the whole concept of the first fruit? It was an offering that had been taken from the early ripened fruit, which distinguished the crop of the land. Its presentation to the priest was accompanied by a prayer of confession that today we have come to the land, although they've come for centuries before. And this is basically a statement that we're not ungrateful for the land God has given us. The fruit that has ripened first among the prime of the field to be set aside as a dedication offering. And this rule expresses an admonition which, as none other, must permanently permeate our Jewish consciousness, that we give the best to God, we're not ungrateful for what God has given us. My Breuer notes that this idea, this institution of Bikurim, which means to take the best of our fruit, the first of our fruit, the first of our crop, and immediately, instead of keeping it for ourselves, designate it that this is going to be a gift for God, this idea, which shows our gratitude toward God, our primacy in our relationship with God, is also echoed in another medrash and another idea. It says it's echoed in a very fascinating medrash when the Torah tells us that Moshe should hew for himself the tablets of the law. So the medrash says, the shaving shall be yours. And this was the source of Moshe's wealth. God said the shavings of the stone belong to Moshe. For I've given the wealth of Egypt to Israel, which did not participate in the mitzvah. And Moshe took care of Yosef's remains to remain poor. I shall give him the shavings of the stone in order that he may become rich. This medrash is a very fascinating medrash. That when the Jewish people were in Egypt, and they were told, and they had sworn to Yosef, or their ancestors had sworn to Yosef, that the time of redemption, please take my bones out of Egypt, that moment of redemption, the Jewish people were so involved in taking the spoils, the booty of Egypt, and borrowing, quote-unquote, all these beautiful things from Egypt, they got so involved in the mitzvah that the first priority was not to take Yosef's bones. And that's how the Jewish people became very rich. Moshe, on the other hand, his first priority was to take the bones of Yosef, therefore didn't have time to get all this material acquisition, so therefore God rewarded him from the shavings of the stone. And that's the verse that it was Moshe who took the Atzmos Yosef, the bones of Yosef. He specifically was involved in this mitzvah. What is the deeper understanding of Moshe being involved in this mitzvah and thereby getting rewarded, and the mitzvah of Bikurim, and the whole concept that we're speaking about? So says Rav Royer, the crux, the common denominator, is really understanding that statement of the Gemara, Shelo Berchu Batorah Tchila. They failed from the first to pronounce a blessing on the Torah. And he notes, according to the profound commentary of our great Rav Zatzal, who's Rav Hirsch, our sages did not trace the cause of our national ruin to the fact that the knowledge of Torah and of our obligation to fulfill its laws had vanished. Even at a time when the book of Torah was still alive in the people's mind, the downfall of the state was a foregone conclusion in the eyes of God. People still studied Torah, still considered it a precious possession for which they were to praise God. But this praise, and this is the key, was not offered first and foremost for possessing the Torah. Shelo berchu b'Torah tchila, it's such a beautiful idea. They didn't recognize the tchila, the beginning aspect, that the first and foremost aspect of their life, and that's what a bracha is. Before we engage in the physical pleasure, we're involved in a bracha. We're involved in the aspect of acknowledging it comes from God. Shelo berchu b'Torah tchila is this understanding and recognition that we don't put God as the primacy of our lives. To the people, the Torah was not the most precious of all values, central source and goal of all their strivings and aspirations. Rather, did the people place their own interests in the foreground and devoted all their time and energy to their achievement. What was left over of time and energy was devoted to the interests of Torah. This was a fateful development, which sooner or later was bound to lead to complete estrangement from God's Torah. And that's what it means, that when our forefathers left Egypt, they had not the slightest intention of breaking the promise made to Yosef. Time left over from the preoccupation with the mitzvah with the idea of the material belongings, then they would give it over to the mitzvah of caring for Yosef's remains. Of course they were going to do it, but what was their priority in life? Their priority in life was first themselves, to fill themselves up as much as possible with physical possessions. Whatever time was left over, so they would devote to getting Yosef's bones. The difference about Moshe Rabbeinu was he was different. His main concern was the bones of Yosef. Shelo berchu b'Torah tchila is really about where is your priority? Where is your focus in life? Rav Breuer points out, he says, this is true of all aspects of Judaism. If God is really a priority, so you're going to make it a priority throughout all of one's aspects of one's life. And it gives the examples as contemporary now as it was 100 years ago. He says, when a person is careful about the laws of kashrut in their home, when they go on a trip, they should likewise be as careful. And they shouldn't say, well, we're on a vacation, so symbols we normally don't use at home we'll use on vacation. If God is the priority, so he's a priority in Honolulu as much as he's a priority in Los Angeles. Wherever you are, God's the same priority. And it continues, the education of our children for the Torah does not permit the parents to be satisfied in devoting a minimum of time to the all-important obligation which requires of them to lead their children before anything else as sources of Torah in order to derive from them the true wealth of life. Our focus in life has to be the bracha before the Torah, the understanding of the primacy of God, the message of Bikurim, of taking the first fruit. And in these and in so many other phases of Jewish life of duty, we must demonstrate our determination first and foremost to pronounce the blessing over the Torah. And then, when we have done our share, turn our attention to the acquisition of material goods, which in turn must be used in the service of Torah and its life-giving goals. And that's how he explains so beautifully that this is what it means, that from the shavings of the stones, which were dedicated to the Torah, did Moshe derive his true wealth. If every conscientious Jew would only be aware hourly and daily of the truth of this statement, following Moshe's example, he will concentrate on hewing the bricks of Torah, and then, with the psola, with the shavings left over, yielded by the construction of these tablets, he will devote his energy to promote his material welfare, and he will feel truly blessed and fortunate with all, be it abundance or modest resources that God will provide him with. This is the spirit of the Bikurim. This is the spirit of Judaism, that we first and foremost give our products to God, and then we gain the right to establish our material foundation with that which remains left over. And this is true, my friends, parenthetically, of our day as well. We get up in the morning, and the first thing we do is we daven. We dedicate the precious moments where we have that tremendous energy. In the morning, we dedicate it to God. And then, the rest of the day, we're clearly, and we'll speak about this, integrate these aspects of godliness, but we always give the best, the finest, the first, and recognize that God is the source of everything. We recognize that our priority in life has to be the spiritual value. And then everything else becomes secondary. And this is why we explain this understanding of God's priority in life. And that allows us this deeper recognition of our dependence on God, explains the statement of the Gemara that he who pronounces the Ashrei three times daily may be certain of ultimate bliss in the world to come. For it contains the verse, Poseach et yadecho masfia lechol chai rason, you open your hand and satisfy the desire of all living beings. He says, spoken daily, this teaches us to view our daily nourishment as a direct gift of mercy by divine grace. And permeated by this knowledge, our lives unfold before the eyes of God. He who pronounces this three times a day transforms his existence into a living challah for which God longs. He will truly live up to the divine expectations of Jewish life. Then is really the secret of what Shemitah is about. Shemitah, one of the main purposes of the Great Shabbat every 7th and 50th year, which are described in detail at the outset of our Sedra, was to foster the spirit to which the Bikurim institution is to instill in the sons of the Jewish people. With Shemitah and Yovel, God demands the proclamation of his rule over his land. Mine is the land, strangers and sojourners are you with me. The key of Shemitah is the key of what Berchu B'Torah Tchila is about. It's the key of what Bikurim is about. It's the key of saying Ashrei three times a day. It's the key of understanding how God is really first and foremost in our lives. The message of Moshe taking care of the bones of Yosef. That our priority in life is to see God. Our priority in life is to see the supremacy in which God runs this world. Is to understand what the Shemitah law does so deeply, that God is in control of everything. That we understand that the land that we are on, that which we believe is our own possession, is really we are sojourners on this land. That God is really in control of our lives. God is in control of the agriculture of our lives. Our whole lives are dependent on God. By giving up that control for a year, it's this recognition that we put God first and foremost in our lives and understand his supremacy in life. Continues Rav Breuer. Immediately after these great statues, there follows the majestic precept instituted by God to build the social structure of his people under the banner of righteousness, honesty, love, and mutual helpfulness. Both chapters belong intimately and insolubly together. For as long as God's nation is fully dedicated to the premise that God is the sole source and possessor of all that it calls its own, will its heart remain receptive for righteousness and loving kindness. And it says, with a Mishlei verse, the sages bemoan the attitude of the greedy ones who attempt to monopolize ownership of early possessions with criminal egoism, who pile up wealth that is not theirs and fail to understand that they actually cause want in their existence, for God deprives them of the right to dwell on his earth, to conquer his world, which harkens back to that Medrash, that if you don't keep Shemitah, if you don't recognize God's supreme hand and that he owns everything, in the end, the person's going to want more and more and to lack more and more. So the person who thinks, well, I can make money by selling things during Shemitah, and doesn't recognize the supremacy of God and God's ownership, in the end will come to lack more and more. I'd like to really focus in on the other aspect. When we recognize that God is the owner, and as Vasema says, we recognize that every year of Shemitah, it's God allowing us to live another 7 years on the land, as the Rechaim Kadosh points out in regard to every week about Shabbos. The keeping of Shemitah is our understanding about how much we are indebted to God. If we understand God's focal point in our lives, so then a person is going to be able, and the upshot of such an understanding is the person's going to be involved in these social laws. And I think there are really two manifestations of this connection. That you see the supremacy of God, a person will then have the open heart to be involved in righteousness and loving kindness. The first is pointed out by the Beis Halevi, the Talei Oros brings. Beis Halevi points out that a person shouldn't say, well, if a person's rich, I can understand they should give tzedakah, they should give charity. But what if a person's poor? So then they shouldn't be obligated to give charity. And we know, our rabbis tell us, that even a person himself who is receiving charitable donations should give something of his possessions over to charity. And further, rabbis say, if a person sees that his money is becoming decreasing, he should make of it by giving tzedakah. Why is this so? And he says the following. He says, generally speaking, we find that a person who has very limited resources and who can argue, well, how can I give tzedakah? I have limited resources. If you look at a person's budget, and clearly it's not true in all cases, but let's take, say, a very average family who says, well, we're just, you know, barely making ends meet, and you expect me to also give charity, an X percent to charity. So says the Beis Halevi, he says, if you really look at this person's budget, you will find that they spend a lot of money to get things that are not really necessary, but are luxuries for them in life. And this person could have easily taken some of that money and given it to tzedakah as well. And he says, this is the concept. When the Medrash says, Oy lanu miyom hadin, oy lanu miyom hatochacha, woe to the person from the day of judgment. Woe to the person from the day of rebuke. That what's going to happen on the day of judgment is God's going to come and say to the person, how come you didn't give charity? And the person's going to say, well, I had limited resources. So then we have the day of rebuke, where God is going to show the person all their money, the budget for the year, what they spent it on. And the person will see that so much of their money was really wasted on things that they really didn't need or could have done without and could have easily given with that money to charity. If a person really believes, and this is the first result of the connection, if a person really believes that their money really comes from God, so then such a person is going to make tzedakah a priority in their lives. The fact that a person says, I really don't have any money for tzedakah, says the Beis Halevi, Ein zot ela ki mitzvah eina chashuva beinav. It's really a reflection that the mitzvah does not have primary importance in a person's eyes. Understanding number one of the relationship between Shemitah and the social laws is if really you understand the primacy of God and you understand that we have to put first and foremost God, Bikurim, Moshe Rabbeinu's model, God in front of us at all times, and that Shemitah teaches us how God has to be the central aspect of our lives here for an entire year, and that God is really in control of everything. If we see the primacy of God, so then one can see that I need in my own life to look very carefully and say, how am I utilizing my money? Am I making me the primary focus or making God the primary focus? If you really take in the message of Shemitah, so a person's focus is going to be, I'm going to make God my primary focus, and I will find money, and I will be able to balance my resources to do that which is really important, and be able to find time and money to give to charity. The second aspect that I think comes from this parsha, and this is probably the more obvious of the two, is that the Talmud Daf Rav Sternbach points out that a person who keeps Shemitah understands so clearly how God is really in charge of the parnassa of a person. Where the laws of Shemitah for an entire year underscore to a person that here you're not involved in planting and reaping, and yet you have plenty of food and you're not lacking anything. This teaches a person a tremendous amount of bitachon, where God takes care of a person. You make God the primary aspect of your life. You step back from working the land for an entire year, God will take care of you. And that explains the Klei Yikar. The reason we can't charge interest is because you take away the aspect of faith within a person. Because a person who charges interest knows that his money is going to come from the money of the interest and not from God. The midah of Shvita, the midah of Yovel, is bitachon, is faith in God. Upshot number two of this connection, if you really have faith in the primacy of God, then you'll have faith that God is the one who provides for us daily. And if you have faith that God provides for us daily, so then you take the law of Shemitah as the prime example, where God provides for us for an entire year. And then if you understand that God provides for you for an entire year, you're going to be very careful in business, that you're not going to say, well, how can I cheat out my friend? How can I make an extra buck here, an extra buck there? How can I charge interest? If you know that God is in charge of money, then you know God will provide for you without the necessity of charging interest, of trying to take care of, trying to cheat your friend out in any way. It's important to note, as Rav Sternbach notes in Talmud Daf elsewhere in this parsha, that a person should not say, the mitzvah of Shemitah is to teach me faith in God, so then I should say, well, this person is poor, let him have faith in God, why should I support him? That's not what the parsha is teaching us. Parsha is teaching us about our relationship with God. One should then not use it on a friend and say, well, if they would have more faith in God, God will take care of them. If a person is poor, it's our responsibility, and God gives us and invests us with that responsibility of taking care of the other person. This is connection number one in Shemitah to social laws and the understanding of Shelo Berechu B'Torah Tchila. Shelo Berechu B'Torah Tchila means we don't make God a priority in our lives. The connection of the two parts of the parsha is Shemitah, like Bikurim, is an example where we make God the prime focus of our lives. An entire year, we give up working the land, we give up security, and we put our total faith in God. A person who has this ability of giving up that entire year of seeing God reign supreme in his life is a person who's then going to be able to open up his heart, make charity a priority, and understand God will take care of him, and that he doesn't have to lend with interest, and that he can give over and help out somebody else. That's aspect number one in our parsha. The second aspect in our parsha, the second connection really, is based on Rav Wolbe in Alei Shur. Rav Wolbe says so beautifully, he says, one of the Yesodos Hamuna, one of the fundamental aspects of faith that every Jew believes in, is the concept of Ashgacha Pratis, the concept of God is ultimately very much intimately involved in our lives. And that everything that happens in this world, all that we think, God has an understanding of the knowledge of people. He knows what's going on in the world. He's bochelei v'choker klayos. He's able to examine the heart of every single person. And this is the yesod of kol ha-Torah kula. This is a fundamental aspect of Torah. And this is something that we see in all aspects of life. When a leaf falls from the ground, or when anything happens, we understand that there was a purpose in this as well. That humakir kol ma'aseinu machshavoteinu u'mishalem schara onesh al hakol. And God is one who's going to pay or repay reward and punishment for everything. Ki hu yisparach manhig otanu mevi otanu al tachlit acharona shehi geula shlema. And ultimately God is leading us to the ultimate redemption. And this is an approach of life that we need to have, where we need to see that everything happens in our lives is really hashgacha pratis. There's a divine reason for that which happens. There is this aspect in life that all that happens in life is this is what God wants us to happen, and this is the way we have to view all the incidences in life, that they're not random, that they don't happen by accident, but rather there is a divine plan, there is a divine direction. And in looking at life in this way, one has the ability to appreciate everything that happens within life. And where I just saw this recently, how it came home so clearly, though it's true of every single day of our lives, is when we were at the Torah Masorah Convention 2 weeks ago. There was a particular Rebbe that I really wanted to ask advice from, who had come in from Israel. And there were 1,500 people at the convention, and I was trying to find her among the crowd, and it's really like trying to find a needle in a haystack. So I said to myself that while there was mixed seating at all the meals, there was separate seating for Shal Shudas. It would be much easier if you only have to find the person among half the crowd. So you're looking among literally hundreds of women sitting at Shal Shudas for this one individual that I wanted to sit and ask advice from. So having walked around for a while and seeing that it was just a sea of faces without any success, I sat back down at the table. I was sitting at a group of 10, 12 women. Our entire table was full except for one empty seat. Went on with Shal Shudas. In the middle of Shal Shudas, who should come and sit in that one empty seat but this particular Rebbetzin I was looking for this entire time? And it just brought home so clearly that there is this Hashgacha Pratis, where God knows so clearly a person needs a certain thing. This is the right time to ask this particular question. Kosh Baruch is going to help you out and put all the situations together. And this is what we have to make here. We have to recognize this, and we have to be grateful for this. This idea of the Hashgacha HaVashem, the divine providence of God, and how God takes care of every single person based on their needs, is so clearly found within the law of Shemitah, more so than any other law. The Torah itself states, and if you say, what shall we eat in the seventh year? Behold, we may not sow nor gather in our produce. Then I will command my blessing upon you in the sixth year, and it will bring forth produce for 3 years, sixth, seventh, and eighth, because you're not planting in the seventh. You need food in the seventh as well as in the eighth. And as Rabbi Miller, Zatzal, and Shabbat Shirim notes, the Ramban explains that in the seventh year, the people will be eating from the sixth year's produce. Consequently, only in the seventh year will they begin to worry about what they will have to eat in the eighth year. Thus the verse reads, if in the seventh year you ask, what shall we eat? The produce of the sixth year, says God, will suffice for 3 years. The Klei Yikar points out a difficulty in the Ramban. How should there be cause for anxiety in the seventh year, seeing that it was promised that the yields in the sixth year would be abundant enough to last 3 or 4 years? Once this has been witnessed in the sixth year, surely one should stop worrying. So why would one ask in the seventh year, what are we going to eat? So says the Klei Yikar very beautifully, that the blessing in the food concern not quantity, but quality. Even if a small measure were eaten, it would satisfy the appetite. This is in fact how Rashi treats the words, v'achaltem l'sova, even if you eat only a little, it will be blessed in your stomach. The blessing was that the food remained the same the sixth year, seventh year, eighth year. But our ability to eat that much, that of what we needed, very reminiscent of the man, where a person got exactly what they needed, this was the bracha of the Shemitah. Not that there was necessarily going to be an abundance of food, but the food that was to be found was going to be able to suffice for all the individuals during this period of time. This is direct hashgacha, that every single person had the exact amount that a person needs. As our rabbis tell us, Mizonosav Shal Adam Ksubim Lomi Rosh Hashanah, the sustenance each of us will have throughout the year has already been fixed on Rosh Hashanah. And how it's given over during the year, that's Nashkach of God, that's the divine providence of God, where when we need more, when we need less, this is the way it's divvied up during the year. This idea of feeling that direct connection of God, how Rav Wolbe says, based on the Ramban, that this is the reason why the Aseret HaDibros, the Ten Commandments, the Anochi Hashem Elokecha, I am the Lord your God, is written in the singular. God has a personal relationship, a personal connection with every single person. It's a Yachas Ishi El Abore, it's a personal connection with God. And this is what a person has to feel. And here comes the key. Says Rav Wolbe, if you understand that we have this personal connection with God, our response is what? Our response is to then treat God with a certain amount of awe. When a king turns individually to a member of the society personally, so then you have to have yiras hakavod, you have to have awe from the glory of God. And says Rav Wolbeck, as we've spoken about before, yira means understanding you're in God's presence. This recognition you're in God's presence. And this is the key. If you take the understanding of the laws of Shemitah to heart, that God is intimately involved in one's life, that God is providing for a person even though they're not doing any physical work on the land, you see such hashkacha pratis, you see such divine providence, one's response has to be yiras Elokim, awe of God. One's response has to be to see the hand of God in our lives at all times, and that we have to respond by behaving in a certain manner which reflects cognizance of God's presence in our lives. And that's why it's not by accident, as Rav Wolbe notes, that in Parshas Bahar, over and over again, we have three cases where the Torah explicitly says, V'yareta melokecha, you should fear God. That the Torah is giving us these sets of laws which really test out, are we faithful, are we loyal to this understanding of God's intimate relationship with us. The three examples, and Rashi develops them, is the first, lo tonu, v'lo tonu ished amito, you shouldn't verbally abuse another person. So here Rashi notes a person shouldn't give a person advice that's not proper advice. It's not appropriate for his lifestyle. And ultimately, you might benefit from giving him wrong advice. So a person may say, well, I didn't really mean to give him bad advice. I thought it was good advice. V'yareitem elokecha, fear God. God understands whether your advice was correct or not. You can't fool God. He knows what's going on in your heart. Likewise, you should not charge interest. And it says, it gives examples, a person shouldn't give his funds to a non-Jew in order then to lend it out to a Jew, because for a non-Jew you're allowed to take interest. Also, God knows what you're doing. If you're really being honest and understanding, God's in front of you, so you're going to be very careful of how you lend out your money as well and who you're going to charge interest to. Third example in our parsha, you can't subjugate the slave through hard labor. And Rashi notes, you can't give him assignments just to torment him. You can't say, warm up this cup for me, and you don't need it. Or hoe under the vine until I come. Whatever it is. And perhaps you'll say, well, I didn't know whether I needed it or not. Again, v'yareitem elokecha, fear God. God knows very clearly whether you're doing this just to harass the person or whether you really meant well. Over and over again in our parsha is the test. Can you take in the concept of Shemitah? If you take in the concept of Shemitah, that God is very intimately involved and personally involved in your life, so then the way you're going to treat others is going to be with this recognition of standing before God. And as Rav Wolbe points out, it's fascinating that all the cases are between man and one's fellow man. That this knowledge of being standing in God's presence is really not tested in religious observance between man and God. Are you chuckling enough in davening? Are you having enough, kavana in davening? That's not where you see the Yareitem Elokecha. You know where the real testing ground is? How do you treat other people? Do you treat other people with self-respect because you understand you're standing in front of God? You've been able to take in the message of what the Shemitah is about, God's intimate relationship with a person, that personal connection. And that, on this level, is what Shelo Berchu B'Torah Tchila is all about. As the Bach notes, a very famous Bach, what does it mean that he failed to say a bracha beforehand? They fail to understand that Torah is meant to be something that's going to permeate our spiritual beings, something that's going to connect us to the notena Torah, the giving of the Torah. That when we keep Torah and mitzvot, the whole point is the bracha, the whole point is the spiritual connection that we have with God. That we're not just keeping Torah and mitzvot because God told us to, but Torah and mitzvot have to transform us as an individual, that we're more spiritual, that we're more careful, that our interpersonal relationships are going to be reflective of the fact that we are Torah Jew. And that's what the bracha means. Asher kedishanu mitzvotav, the purpose of the mitzvah, is to sanctify us and to inspire us to holiness, Rabbi Lev points out in Outlooks and Insights. The second bracha emphasizes the purpose of the Torah, to make us Yodei Shemecha, those who know and emulate God's character traits, in order to develop a complete Torah personality. And the third bracha, Asher Bachar Banu, that He's chosen us, so we have to see that we're a special nation. The bracha enjoins us not to merely hear the words, but to consider their implications. Shelo berchu b'Torah tchila means that although they study Torah, they didn't allow it to become a spiritual experience of connecting to God, of Yodei Shmecha, of emulating God's character traits. I think both of these answers really connect together in one fundamental principle that I think we can take as for our lives, which is so important and so crucial. And that is to be able to see the whole picture. Rabbi Lev points out that there's a great verse in Isaiah, which when castigating the Jewish people for serving God, he uses the following phrase, command by command, line by line, a little here and a little there. His rebuke was based on the failure to integrate the observance of all the mitzvot into a unified service of God. Just as Hashem is one, so too is will one. He is the one all-encompassing request of man. And that's the fear of God. The 613 mitzvot are meant to emulate God. And he notes that since we're human beings in a physical world, we cannot relate to God's will without it being broken down to segments that we can deal with individually. It's like looking at 613 small windows, but the small windows have to uncover a larger picture underneath. The individual mitzvot are merely partial manifestation of God's one all-inclusive will. Each mitzvah is a window through which we glimpse a portion of that will. Thus, there's more to leading a Torah life than merely observing 613 rules. The ultimate goal is to understand the implications of each mitzvah in the context of the overall divine will that must shape our personality, outlooks, and actions. In addition to listening to God's voice, we have to listen b'kol Hashem unto God's voice, an understanding of the implications and meanings of those mitzvot in the broader context. Observance of the Torah, tzav l'tzav, kav l'kav, rule by rule, without sensitivity to the aspects of the divine will revealed in each mitzvah is inadequate. This is the problem. This was the deficiency at the generation of the Chorban. They kept the mitzvot and learned Torah, but did so on a perfunctory level. They're doing mitzvah after mitzvah, and this is the challenge that we have as well, that sometimes we're involved in one mitzvah after another mitzvah. And yes, we're doing each individual mitzvah so beautifully, but do we see that all the mitzvahs together are supposed to have an impact on our character, are supposed to make us more sensitive people? So that when I'm nice to somebody and I help somebody walk across the street, or I stand up for an older person, or I treat somebody with respect, that small mitzvah then has to impact who I am as a larger person. It has to impact my relationship with God. It can't begin and end at the mitzvah. What does that say about me? How am I growing through that mitzvah? How am I becoming a larger picture? This is the key. If we make God a priority in our lives, if we see that life is about the spiritual connection to God, integrating what God is all about. What life is really about is to see the whole picture. That if God is a priority and every mitzvah is supposed to bring us to that realization of priority and closeness to God, so that's what we have to ask ourselves. Are we so caught up in the trees that we lose the forest? Are we so caught up in the individual mitzvahs that we forget that mitzvahs are supposed to impact us, they're supposed to change us, they're supposed to help us grow as people? And that what could happen is we can look back after 70, 80 years of our lives and say, well, I have a large pile, stockpile of mitzvot, but am I a changed person? Am I a different person than I was 50 years ago? Am I a more developed person? And here's the key, am I a more integrated person? Do I see the entire picture? Or am I tzav l'tzav, kav l'kav, line by line, command by command? I think finally, perhaps, this is a deeper understanding of what the Sfasema says, that the smichus of the parshios is the aspect of achdus, the aspect of oneness. That Shemitah makes everybody equal, rich and poor, nobody works the land. Clearly the laws of helping somebody out is to create this social unity among people, that the rich help the poor, even the poor help the poor, as we spoke about, this oneness. And I think that this aspect of oneness is really the key of what the parsha is about. The oneness of Shemitah, where everyone is equal. The oneness of helping out in the social laws ultimately has to lead to a oneness within ourselves, that we're not a fragmented aspect of people who keep different aspects of mitzvot, but we're able to emulate the oneness of God and see the totality of what life is about and be able to live as a whole composite person who every mitzvah just allows a person to grow in this oneness in the relationship to self, in relationship to others, and relationship to God. And therefore, in conclusion, the two ideas that we saw to get today that leads us to that final idea is the connection between Shemitah and the laws of charity, is that Shemitah teaches us the primacy of God in our lives. Shlo berchu b'tarah tchila. They didn't make God first and foremost. They didn't say a blessing conceptually before they learned. It wasn't a priority. That if you see God as a priority, you're able to step back and see God as in control, the Bikurim, what Shemitah is about. So then you'll be open up to helping another person. You'll have the confidence that this is the priorities I need to set in my life, and God will provide for me. I don't have to try to get money out of people. God will provide for me. The second level is clearly if you see the law of Shemitah, you see God's divine hand in a person's life, and that therefore has to lead to the most deepest part of a person, that yira, that awe of God, that you're not trying on a very subliminal level to try to cheat somebody out. You see clearly God standing in front of you. Shlo berchu b'tarah tchila, they didn't have that spiritual acknowledgement of the deep aspect that Torah mitzvot have to have a religious implication. Both approaches lead us to this final achdus, this final oneness of looking at life, of realizing that religion is a top priority in our life, that this is our main focus in life, to run our lives around God, and to understand that the mitzvot are not just to do individual mitzvot, but they have to impact us on as a whole. And as the Ramban notes in the Gerut HaRamban, that when a person completes learning something, when you rise from your study, ponder carefully what you have learned, see what there is in it that you can put into practice. And on a much deeper level, to take this one step further, see how it impacts you as a person. After having done the mitzvah, see how you as a person have changed because of it, or how you as a person can change as a result of this mitzvah, and try to take this mitzvah not just as a small composite part, but to see how it fits into a larger picture, a larger structure that a person is building. The achdus, the oneness, which is Sfas Emet says, is the theme of our parsha.